On the 21st of April, EMI will be releasing David's new album, Never Let Me Down, which will be released simultaneously worldwide on vinyl, cassette, and compact disc. This Monday, 23rd of March, a single from that album, Day In and Day Out, will be released simultaneously worldwide. The new album, Never Let Me Down, which comprises all new material, is produced by David and Dave Richards, and will be the third studio album for EMI America.
And I'm David Bowie. And you're not. David, you've got fame and you've got wealth. What is left for you? I want this tour to be very successful and enjoy it.
Well, I don't think he ended up enjoying it. And for the millions of people who saw him around the world, not many of them really ended up enjoying it either. It was the Glass Spider tour. It was a bit of a nightmare. It was overblown, loud. It was red jumpsuits, big mullets. It was hands in the air. It was everyone singing along now. And it was that bloody great big spider stuck on the middle of the stage. I don't think Bowie himself was particularly enamored of this tour. In later years, he said it was something that he felt he had to do. But Never Let Me Down, the album that we're talking about today, is not as tragic as it might appear to be. I mean, it's an album I've always thought was rubbish, frankly. I mean, I've listened to it maybe two or three times in my life. I remember the singles from it, and even at the age of 13 when it came out, I was enough of a rock snob to know what was crap and what was not, and this was definitely crap. I was into Paul McCartney. Huh, yeah, once upon a long ago. But Never Let Me Down was, in fact, Bowie's third and final EMI album. As we just heard, they were very excited about it, even if he wasn't, audibly. And it was an album full of attempts at, I don't know, it was kind of quite a sketchy record. There are lots of different styles here. There are lots of different ideas. There's very much a voguish post-Live Aid social conscience at the fore. There's stylistically a lot of big synths and a lot of loud clattering snares. It is recorded in Montreux in 86, and it sounds it. Bowie later on disowned this album pretty much. He said it was just a terrible production. The songs were okay, but really they were just smothered in ephemeral sound effects. He did have a sneaking fondness of this record, I think, and he has revisited it from time to time on tour. But on the whole, it's not an album that has stood the test of time well. And so therefore, I was surprised when Nicholas Pegg, who you last heard here extolling the virtues of the majestic Space Oddity album from 1969, asked if he could talk about Never Let Me Down. And rather like David Quantick last week, I thought, well, maybe it'll be interesting to hear what these erudite, authoritative figures have to say about something which I've rather lazily dismissed as being an absolute crock of piffle. So Nicholas Pegg came along and he sat down, and I have to admit, it's one of the most entertaining conversations I've had for a long time. So without very much more further ado, obviously I was going to give you a whole rundown of the, you know, all the people who play on the album and everything like that, but you know, you can find that stuff out easily and it's just going to slow everything down here. So let's get on with it. So here is Nick Pegg and myself talking about Never Let Me Down. We're here today to talk about an album that, really the album that you tell me introduced you to David Bowie, the album that first caught you. And unlike many people and many critics and many music fans, it's not Ziggy and it's not Low and it's not Heroes and it's not Scary Monsters mm-hmm. and it's not even Let's Dance.
Nope. No.
What is it, Nick?
Well, the album that I've chosen to talk about is the dreaded, much maligned, Never Let Me Down.
Fairly maligned?
From 1987.
Justly maligned?
Now, I'm just going to pull you up a little bit, actually, Arsene. It's not really the album that first introduced me to David Bowie. What it was for me was it was the first new Bowie album that came out after I'd become a hardcore fan.
Right.
So, you know, I always loved Bowie. I mean, I always say the earliest one I can remember, I think, was Rebel Rebel in 1974. And by the time Sound and Vision and Low, Heroes, those ones came out, I was, you know, I loved it. But I didn't really become a totally obsessed, reading all the biographies, getting all the bootlegs sort of fan until the mid-80s. And so, yes, I was already familiar with, you know, Hunky Dory and Ziggy and all of those, of course. But Never Let Me Down, as I say, was my first new Bowie album as a fan. So I'm very fond of it for that reason, you know. Now, I'm not going to sit here today and try to tell you that I think that Never Let Me Down is David Bowie's undiscovered masterpiece. Okay,
I'm really... Come on, it'd be fun.
I do think that it's an album that has a great deal of interest in it. And hey, look, a disappointing David Bowie album is still far more interesting than most of anyone else's stuff, isn't it?
It's true.
even a disappointing one. And I think the thing about Never Let Me Down is it has become almost a sort of, you know, it's become legendary as his bad album. It's the one that it's okay to say a load of old rubbish. And I think that's quite unfair. No one's going to, you know, I won't disagree that the 1980s were his most bumpy decade. Of course, he didn't actually bring out that many albums in that decade. And there was, it was certainly a decade of mixed fortunes for him. It was a difficult period. But in consigning all of that disappointment to one album, you know, channeling it all into Never Let Me Down as if that's, you know, if we hate that one, then we can get on with liking everything else. And I think that's quite unfair because I think it's a really interesting album and I'm very fond of it. And it's not perfect. I think it sounds very dated. In fact, I think I'd go so far as to say it's probably the most dated sounding Bowie album because it's, you know, one of its problems is I think in retrospect is that the production style is very, very of its time. So it does sound very, very mid to late 80s.
Yeah, yeah.
But the songwriting on it, I think, is more vigorous and more interesting and the lyrics and than certainly other albums of the 1980s that I could
absolutely
mention, you know,
I mean,
and
Tonight really was very thin indeed, wasn't
that's
it?
That's right. I mean, I'm fond of them all because I'm a huge, huge old David Bowie fan, of course, but Tonight has the wonderful Loving the Alien on it and the fairly wonderful Blue Jean. But it's, after that, the slim pickings, I think, you know, and again, Tonight is not a brilliantly produced album. That's also of its time. Let's Dance, which is a beautifully produced album, of course. Can't take that away. You know, it's immaculate, gorgeous Nile Rodgers production. But the songs, for me, I think Let's Dance itself is obviously one of Bowie's towering classics. Brilliant, brilliant song. The rest of the album, I love it, but it's, I think Never Let Me Down has got an awful lot more meat on it. That's what I think the songwriting, and also, of course, Let's Dance and Tonight both have an awful lot of cover versions on them.
That's true.
Yes. Never Let Me Down has just got the one cover version on an Iggy Pop song at the end, and a couple of the others are co-written with other people, but it's got way more new writing on it, you know, so in that respect, it's, and I think Bowie was getting back into, For all that album's faults, he was getting back into his more accustomed territory of fractured imagery and experimental lyrics, and he was writing songs that were actually about stuff. Now, I'm not saying, you know, I think Loving the Alien and Let's Dance and all those songs are also about stuff, but there's some really interesting material on Never Let Me Down. And for better or worse, you know, every David Bowie album is a sort of bridge between the previous album and the next album.
Yeah.
That's an observable phenomenon, you know. Ziggy Stardust is exactly halfway between Hunky Dory and Aladdin Sane, stylistically, musically, and, you know, all those ways. And in the same way, I think Never Let Me Down, for better or worse, is exactly halfway between Tonight and Tin Machine. And now that's an interesting place to be, isn't it? I mean, that's quite...
Well, when you put it that way, then yes, I can see. But to quote your own book, I mean, didn't Bowie begin by saying that this album was a return for me, like a renaissance? I'm going back to the core, back to the basics, back to guitar.
That's right. He was already at that point talking with a certain air of disappointment, shall we say, about his last couple of albums and saying, you know, I've lost my way a little bit. Of course, as we know, you know, Let's Dance changed everything for Bowie in 83 because that album was a bigger hit than he'd ever had before. He was suddenly something that he'd never quite... He'd had number ones and he'd toured around the world, but he'd never been this stadium rock sort of, you know, playing massive outdoor arenas, doing a massive world tour on that scale. It was a new thing to him. And for a few years after that, you know, he had to come to terms with that sort of, that level of fame. And he sort of went with, you know, rolled with that for a while and went a bit mainstream. And Never Let Me Down was, I think, his first attempt to pull back from that. And he said at the time, yes, this is, I think he said something along the lines of, this is a continuation from Scary Monsters rather from the last two, you know, which is an interesting thing for him to say. And certainly it's a harder sounding album. It's much
Definitely,
more guitar-y.
Yeah.
It's got much more attack. It's a much more muscular album, I think. Yeah.
Going back to this point of just very briefly to go back to Let's Dance. Now, as you mentioned, this was the big, big, big album. This was designed, crafted, and built for hits, for mass acceptance, for a global tour. So is it true to say this is what he wanted? He wanted at that stage, he wanted to have number ones. He wanted to be played in clubs. He wanted to shed this view of this sort of, you know, strange alternative figure hovering in Berlin, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, I think throughout his career, Bowie alternated, didn't he? He veered between these things. He you know, he was a canny operator. You know, he would bring out an album or two of really quite uncompromising artsy stuff, and then he would go for a commercial strike. You know, and he did this more than once. But certainly that particular album. I mean, Nile Rodgers tells the story that you know, he assumed that David Bowie made art.
Yeah.
And if it happened to be a hit, then so be it. But apparently what Bowie said to him in no uncertain terms was, I've brought you in on this because I want you to make hits.
Yeah.
Now, a little bit of background on that, of course. Bowie had just been released or ended his contract with RCA, the record label that he'd been with throughout most of the 70s. And he had a new recording contract. Well, in fact, no, he didn't at the time. He recorded Let's Dance, he didn't. He recorded an album which he wanted to be a great big commercial success. And then there was a bit of a bidding war with some labels, and he signed with EMI, and it went on from there. So yes, he was very conscious, having been away for a couple of years. Scary Monsters was in 1980. So that was actually at the time the longest gap between Bowie albums that there had been since he, you know, first broke through. So yeah, there's no question about it. Let's Dance was designed to give him some hits, no question. Yeah.
So then, of course, now we fast forward to 87, and, well, recorded in 86. Never
That's right.
Down.
That's right.
Where was our man at that time, spiritually, psychically, romantically, financially? Where can you give us a brief pen portrait of David Bowie circa 85, 86?
Gosh. Well,
not everything, but
no,
okay. The last time we'd seen him, the world had seen him, had been at, say, Live Aid.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
He had a massive hit with Absolute Beginners. I think that was early 86.
Early 86.
Okay,
yes,
so
yes.
He was kind of on a bit of a high.
Went to number two. Would have got to number one had it not been for Chain Reaction by Diana Ross. But hey, that was a great song too.
Great
but that's,
song.
That's what kept Absolute Beginners
Just
off number one.
If the Gibb Brothers had produced David Bowie.
Wow, yeah, imagine that. I do think the production on Absolute Beginners is great.
It is.
It's Langer and Win Stanley, the
really?
People who worked with Madness.
The Madness Girls, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it's a great track, that. It's one
very
of my favourites.
Epic.
Yeah, it really is.
Big,
it's beautiful,
yeah.
Isn't it? Yeah, I mean, that's a case in point. You see, I don't subscribe to this idea that everything that Bowie did in the 80s was rubbish. I think we've already established that. But, I mean, Absolute Beginners isn't just an above-average effort from a lean period. It's one of his great recordings, I think. But anyway, going back to your question, yeah, the last time we'd really seen him, you know, on stage was Live Aid in the summer of 85. He was working a lot on movies and things at the time, of course.
Yes.
Live Aid fell in the middle of the filming of Labyrinth. Mm. He'd already just finished working on Absolute Beginners, which he, of course, appeared in as well. And he went straight onto Labyrinth after that and filmed those two back-to-back, both in London. So he was in Britain for most of 85. And that's where a lot of his energies were going. EMI were very keen for him to, produce some more product, because he hadn't had a proper album out since Tonight in 84. And he was
Which
also,
they must have been disappointed with.
Yeah, I guess, yeah.
No, not Rogers. I think it was Derek Bramble.
Derek Bramble
and
Hugh Padgett.
That's
Padgett,
right. Yeah.
Worked on
So EMI
Tonight,
must have been like,
yeah,
come on.
And there was talk about bringing out an album of called Dance, which was an album of the sort of collected remixes and 12-inch things from
very
mid
80s.
Very, very, very mid 80s thing to do.
I remember getting Eurythmics Touch Dance, which
right.
is the same thing, you know,
yeah.
like the album, and then just these endless club mixes
yeah.
and 12-inch mixes with lots of marimbas and congas and stuff.
That's right. Oh, the marimba. That was the instrument of 1983-84.
It was.
It's all over.
Congas,
Thompson Twins,
marimbas,
and
yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And it's all over tonight, marimbas, isn't it? On Loving the Alien and things.
Oh, yeah, Pinky, that's
Gonky.
True. Yeah,
yeah.
yeah. yeah.
Rather like that sound, actually. That's but yeah, again, okay. That sounds so 80s, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's sort of like Hold Me Now by the Thompson Twins is
right,
what always
right.
goes in my head.
So Dance was
so that,
the
that
last
was,
attempt to squeeze something
That was an
out
idea,
of,
but then that was yeah. canned because he finally having also he was producing Iggy Pop as well, of course. He was,
oh,
he,
blah,
was
blah, blah.
He worked on Blah 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 with Iggy Pop in Montreux. That was earlier in 86 he made that album, and having done that one, he thought, yes, this is quite a good, you know, I'm going to go in and do my own one now. And so yeah, he recorded Never Let Me Down towards the end of 86.
So who was on board here? So at this point, and this is a really interesting point, he wasn't working with Tony Visconti.
That's right.
His long term.
That's right.
His almost his muse, really. I mean, Visconti and Bowie together when they're on form are.
I think Tony Visconti was David Bowie's most empathetic producer. Sure. He absolutely got Bowie. They were old friends, of course. They first met way back in '67, and they not always worked together. You know, there's a period that the Hunky Dory and Ziggy Stardust weren't with Tony Visconti because Tony was working with Mark Bolan at that point. But yes, they got back together again in the mid '70s after they worked on some of the very early stuff and Space Oddity and so on. But then the Space Oddity album, that is, not the single, of course, but that thereby hangs another tale. But they got back together in the mid-70s for Diamond Dogs and Young Americans, and they worked together on the Berlin albums and Scary Monsters. But then, yes, by the early 80s, the last thing they did together before the big sort of break was the Baal EP. You know, Bowie appeared
really?
In
Before Breakfast
at Baal. Yeah, that's right. But they went into the studio and recorded a really very beautiful version of the song. They're not the same as the songs that you hear him sing actually in the TV production. I mean, they're the same songs, but the
different recordings.
The different recordings, yes. Right. The studio recording, the EP, is much more lavish and really beautiful thing.
Which just come out now on the box set, haven't they?
That's right.
It's really the first time I've properly heard that.
That's right, because it was unavailable for years.
Yeah.
So that was the last time he worked with Tony for a long, long time. And in the 80s, because, you know, Bowie was always very realistic about the fact that he had to change. You know, he had to ring the changes and get new people in. And hence, for example, you know, Nile Rodgers was what he needed at the time, you know, and you know, the results were fantastic. But yes, through the 80s, he went from one producer to another with varying results. But on Never Let Me Down, he co-produced it himself with David Richards, who was a studio engineer at Montreux, who had worked on other Bowie albums in Montreux prior to that. He'd worked as an engineer on some of the other stuff that Bowie had done.
Yeah,
but this was the
Heroes,
first time he co-produced. He engineered on Heroes. So yeah, this was he was the co-producer on Never Let Me Down, and would go on to work on other Bowie albums like the of Suburbia and
David Richards did that,
because that was recorded in Montreux as well. And it was a new tryout for Bowie production wise and he had some of his old faithful musicians around, people like Carlos Alomar. I think it's a bit of an injustice just to call him a rhythm guitarist, but he played second guitar. He was Bowie's band leader.
He was a band leader
a lot of the tours. You know, Carlos is just I think he's a genius musician. I think he's one of the great underrated Bowie collaborators. Mm. And, you know, this is the man who plays those amazing sort of whirling guitar riffs on things like Golden Years and Fame, of course. And he's on Never Let Me Down doing some, I think, wonderful experiments with guitar synthesizer and things like that. Yeah, so he was part of the mix.
But wasn't he playing more second fiddle to the mighty Frampton.
The mighty Frampton.
Frampton Meister.
Now, this is another thing about Bowie, isn't it? He a lot of his albums have, you know, he would draft in a sort of celebrity guest lead guitarist. You know, there's obviously one thinks of Robert Fripp on Heroes and Scary Monsters.
Bowie's definition of celebrity.
Yeah, well, I guess.
Fripp. Okay.
And of course, Mick Ronson back in the day and so on. But yeah, on this one, Peter Frampton was an old schoolmate of Bowie's from Bromley Technical High School. Years and years before, of course, when they were boys, and by this stage, Peter Frampton had had his moment of fame in the mid 70s. He was a huge star for a short period, but he was a huge star. And Bowie, invited him back in to play on Never Let Me Down. He's not on every track, but he does play most of the guitar solos on it. Bowie plays lead on a couple of them, and a guy called Sid McGuinness plays on a couple of them as well. So there's three lead guitarists on Never Let Me Down. And of course, Frampton went on tour maybe we'll get on to talk about that as well. The even more maligned Glass Spider Tour.
To the Glass Spider Tour. I'm not letting you off the hook with that.
Okay.
so we have a band. And I've read that Alomar wasn't exactly delighted with the sessions, with the final product. I mean, was he marginalised here a little bit?
Well, it's interesting. Yes, again, the process was rather different. The Berlin albums were very much everyone dived in and experimented together, and Carlos Alomar was in the heart of, you know, trying out things and contributing things and making suggestions. What happened on Never Let Me Down was that Bowie went in beforehand and recorded some basic demos in which he and a couple of other people played a wonderful Turkish multi-instrumentalist, another unsung hero of Bowie, actually, Erdal Kızılkay, who worked on a lot of Bowie stuff. They recorded the demos together and then the band were brought in and, you know, were, as I understand it, were played the demos and, you know, Bowie said, there you go, do it like that, right. but do it better. So I think Carlos, yeah, he said later in interviews that he was a bit disappointed that he was basically being asked, you know, to imitate someone who was imitating him.
Exactly. You know? So previously where he would have set the course of the evolution of the music, here he was just being given a task and given a guitar almost and just saying, well,
yeah,
do that.
Yeah, absolutely. Better. And now I'm sure that Carlos did more than that on Never Let Me Down. I'm sure he brought his own personality and his own work to it, but yes, there was a sense in which he wasn't there at the beginning of it. You know, the songs were already. Of course, that's not the case with every one of the songs. An interesting little point about Never Let Me Down is that most of the tracks were, as I've just said, you know, demoed and prepared in advance and then recorded. But the one exception is the title track, which was recorded. Written, recorded, and finished in 24 hours, which is completely different from the rest of the album, which was done over a, you know, long period of time. Never Let Me Down itself, that song, was co-written with Carlos. Bowie just suddenly had an idea. By this time, they weren't in Montreux anymore. They decamped to New York to add some more overdubs and for Bowie to do most of his vocals. And Bowie suddenly came up with a new song, and Carlos came in to lay down some guitar, and during the process of that, actually contributed, changed the chord sequence and things, and so he ended up getting a co-writing credit on it, because Bowie was always very good about that. If someone had really joined in and
they would get a credit.
And it's interesting, isn't it, that this last minute song, I think if you listen to it on the album, and you know, much as I'm defending the whole album, that's definitely one of the best tracks, and the fact that it was done on the fly in a day, and also of course interesting that Bowie ended up naming the album after it, so he obviously thought quite highly of that song.
When I was listening through to it recently, I mean, obviously we can't use music on the podcast, but I just want to have a quick listen to a bit of it and just remind myself of it, because yeah, I remember listening through to it thinking that is not bad at all. We've just listened to something that we're not allowed to play, which is the song itself. But it has reminded me that I'm moving towards Nick's point of view on this, coming from my own rather admittedly lazy perspective. This is a
am I talking you into something?
You're talking me into this.
Good.
We've just taken a minute out to listen to the title track, Never Let Me Down, which has got these wonderful sunshiny Carlos Alomar guitar flourishes, a lovely serpentine chord progression, a very winsome, sweet Bowie vocal on this. It sounds a very happy, content track.
Yeah.
It's a really lovely what we think of. Yeah, when we think of this album.
Another interesting thing about that track, of course, is he's quite clearly riffing on his old friend John Lennon as well. You know, vocally, I wouldn't go so far as to say he's impersonating Lennon, but he's certainly channeling him a bit, isn't he? And then there's some whistling towards the end of the track, and one thinks of jealous guy that whistles. Yeah, and that's something that Bowie did a lot throughout his career. You know, he was a brilliant mimic, but he didn't just mimic people, but he certainly, you know, channeled the, and you see this elsewhere on Never Let Me Down, actually. There's a song called Shining Star, which I'm not going to claim is one of the best songs on the album, but he's doing a Smokey Robinson on that
really?
One.
Was he a big Smokey Robinson fan?
Oh, he was a huge fan of everything, and he loved
Soul. Very discerning.
I think on you might even be able to claim that on Time Will Crawl, he's doing a bit of Neil Young, who was another great idol of his.
That's true, actually, in the verses.
Yeah,
Very nasal.
Yeah, that's right.
All on one note, kind of Neil Young.
That's right, right. And you know, he did this on you know, many... He it's not that he was impersonating people, or I mean, he did sometimes just take them off. He impersonates Mark Bolan outrageously on a couple of early ones. On Black Country Rock, isn't it?
Yeah.
On The Man Who Sold the World.
Tony Visconti
went as far as actually thinning his voice out of equalization to make it sound. Does have sort of a bleating noise. And that's just him having a laugh. You
Prettiest
know?
Star.
Yeah, that's right. And there is a wonderful outtake from Absolute Beginners, the song Absolute Beginners, where which came to light after Bowie died, which someone put up on the internet, the engineer who worked on that, who, you know, in which Bowie is just, for a laugh at the end of the day, impersonating everyone from Iggy Pop to Lou Reed, and it's just blissful.
Oh dear, Lou Reed. Okay, Iggy then. Iggy.
Joe Moore.
Yeah, okay.
When the fire broke out on the Rio Grande,
my foot to the board and she did up the sand with the horse of the south track tailing behind. Father and Sue, please, when the fire broke out on the Rio Grande, left nothing standing but the smell of the land and hubcaps of birth, so the screen of your hand, nothing left at all but the sound of a rock and roll band.
Difficulty somewhere between all of them. I couldn't even get near to him.
He was an extraordinary vocal technician. You know, he knew how to use his voice as a musical instrument and his ability to modulate it. And, you know, he would sometimes deliberately sing a tiny, tiny little bit flat, not flat enough to make it sound horrible, but enough to give the song a sort of mournful quality.
Right.
And this sort of thing, you know, he was an extraordinary, but that doesn't mean he was just technical. I think, you know, there's I think he's actually a very underrated singer, you know.
He is. People don't tend to talk of Bowie as being a singer. You know, he's more seen as a conceptualist, as a, he, you know, his perceived disdain for rock and roll, which he himself would come out with occasionally.
Right, yeah.
You know, doesn't place him as being a singer. And just to pick up on another point made very quickly, Neil Young. I mean, you don't think of Bowie and Neil Young necessarily as being anything remotely similar, but there are these strange parallels for his career. I mean,
that's right.
Famously, Kooks was written after listening to, what was it, he was listening to Harvest?
That's right, yes, yes. And there's a couple of Neil Young tracks that clearly are very...
I've Been Waiting For You on...
Yes, and he covered it, indeed, yeah, that's exactly. Right. Yeah.
So that's an interesting little song.
Yeah, he loved Neil Young, yeah.
But to go back to, so to this theme for his voice and his singing, which is a very interesting theme, and I remember reading somewhere, I don't know again if this was Alamar, but someone saying, on Never Let Me Down, he's really singing again.
Yeah,
and there was like a lot of praise for his voice. That I think was it Alamar?
So I think Carlos did mention it at the time, and it's quite right. Yes, yeah. Indeed, that, you know, compared with you know, on Let's Dance and Tonight, by and large, he's using that very rich baritone that was another of his great sort of weapons in his arsenal, wasn't it? You know, and he's bellowing Let's Dance and Blue Jean and those songs. You know, and on Never Let Me Down, on a lot of the songs, instead he's reverted back to that very sort of, it's powerful, but it's a very, that very high sort of, you know, it's got a, intrinsically got a bit more sort of rock attack to it rather than, it's not as croony an album as, I mean, on Some of Tonight, he goes total croon, doesn't he? I mean, I'm not a fan of that cover of God Only Knows, and for example, that's a bit too croony for me. Sorry,
apparently, he wanted to do that on Pinups.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he did record a version of it with the Astronauts back then. You know, an album that never got released that he sort of half.
With Ava Cherry.
Finished with Ava Cherry and Co. Yeah. And there is a version of God Only Knows was among the things they did there. And actually very similar, the arrangement and everything is very similar to the one that he ended up doing on Tonight. But, you know, interesting, isn't it, that he went back to that song after all those years. And, yeah, you know, it's a very proficient thing. I'm not going to diss it, really. It's just not quite my cup of tea.
I think you can fairly safely say it's crap. it really is rubbish. I respect your scholarship and I respect your opinion here, but I've listened to that version of God Only Knows, and my God, I mean, God Only Knows why he did it.
Yeah, I don't think I've heard many, many cover versions of God Only Knows, and I've never heard one that comes anywhere near the Beach Boys version. You know, I just
think maybe it's a song that song.
Oh, I don't know. Is there a good cover version of that song?
Isn't McCartney's favorite song of all time?
Is it?
Yeah, I think so. In one of those.
Yeah.
It always pops up in those Q&As. I mean, his personal favourite is Here, There and Everywhere.
Yeah.
And then his favourite song is either God Only Knows or... No, it is good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Surprised he hasn't done it.
After a self-imposed absence of nearly 4 years, musical artist David Bowie is on the prowl once again, leading the cutting edge of rock style with a hot new album, Never Let Me Down, and an even hotter new world tour called the Glass Spider Tour.
Touring is starting to change, interestingly enough. Which I think can only be good. It's nice to see an emphasis back on live shows again, because it sort of petered out for a bit there. But I find now there's a new energy in live performance.
There's one interesting thing about the Glass Spider Tour, which is very significant, especially given the fact I live in Berlin, is that it's still remembered by many Berliners as a very, very important day.
That's right.
Because it took place, as you know, it took place right by the wall. And I don't know if you saw the... Obviously, no, you mentioned you haven't been to Berlin, but in the Berlin version of the David Bowie Is exhibition a few years ago, they had a whole room devoted to Berlin objects.
Yeah.
And they had this fascinating vitrine full of correspondence and reports from the Stasi.
Wow.
About this English singer.
Yeah.
And because obviously it caused an absolute commotion.
Yes.
Because kids were just pressing up against the wall. Because I think he did it in Potsdamer Platz.
That's right, yeah.
And
yeah.
they could hear it. And there were all the, and the, obviously there were official reports.
And, yeah. And the riot police were called, weren't they? Yeah, I mean, exactly. And yet Bowie talked about it afterwards, saying, you know, that this was, to him, he was, you know, it was the performance, particularly, of course, when they did the song Heroes.
Yeah.
Which, of course, was just written there.
Unbearably moving to hear in that
and
context.
And this was, what was it? It was two and a bit years before the wall came down. And it was spoken of afterwards as part of the, you know, a little swell, or maybe not so little, in the movement that eventually helped to bring about, you know, the wall coming down. It was a really defining moment culturally, you know. Mm. Yeah, yeah. Thousands of people pressed up against the wall on the other side. I mean, can you imagine how emotional that must have been? Yeah, I mean, Bowie always talked about it as the greatest performance of Heroes that he would ever give.
Yeah.
You know, and it just sort of came about, you know.
Couldn't be any more resonant, could it?
Yeah.
In that setting with, like you say, this kind of groundswell, which was building up at that time. I think Springsteen played. So that's definitely a huge highlight of Bowie's career, which, like you say, he's mentioned a few times. To go back to the album now, because I think we should just, before we wrap up, we just want to get your takes on a couple of the songs here that really have intrigued me.
You're saying I've got to talk you into a couple of things, aren't you? Which one? What are we going for?
All right, Nick, can you talk me to Zeros? Now, Zeros to me is a very peculiar track. It's slightly Princey in the sense. It kind of, you know how Prince was doing that sort of like slight 60s psychedelia retro thing? Here we begin with a kind of like Diamond Dog style intro. There's sort of like the screams of
the crowd.
Yes,
there's a sort of, it's a kind of fake synthesized it's crowd fake, screaming, isn't it?
And it's
it?
A fake band. Here come the Zeros almost.
Yeah.
And then we sort of, you know, drift through this sort of quite, to my mind, rather clunky track. And then with a sort of 60-ish sitar.
It's got sitars and it's got Asian percussion. And
exactly. Yeah, I think I read, if not in your book and somewhere else, that the actual sitar played was owned by Jimi Hendrix and then given to Peter Frampton, and then he played that actual model. Yeah.
Right.
So, amazing facts.
Amazing, isn't it? Yeah, yeah.
Zeros to me is, so, you know, the puns and the jokes from Heroes to Zeros.
This is an interesting, I mean, of course, his self-reflexive habit is out in force on this album, as it is on so many others. Yeah, of course, David Bowie couldn't write a song called Zeros without everyone thinking of Heroes, of course. Just as he couldn't write a song called Glass Spider without everyone thinking Spiders from Mars, which he's done Spiders.
But he is very, very actively here revisiting the 60s.
Oh, very much so. It's not just the sitar. Yeah, yeah, he's singing about, and there's lots of little gags in the lyrics of that song, which are rather lovely. Well, I think they're rather lovely. You know, there's a bit where he sings, "Something good is happening, I don't know what it is." That is a little self-effacing, quite complicated joke about a quote from Bob Dylan.
Yeah.
What's it called? Ballad of the Thin Man.
Yeah.
In which Dylan says, "Something is happening, but you don't know what it is, do you,
Mr. Jones?"
Yeah. So, of course, David Bowie is Mr. So he sings, "Something is happening, I don't know what it is." I think that's elegant.
Yeah.
I don't know, some people might think that's terribly forced, but I think that's rather lovely. So he's harking back. I think it's actually a song about, of course, the great thing about David Bowie is that none of his songs are about
anything.
A single thing. You know, they can be about whatever you want them to be. So for me, it is, at least in part, a song about the way that David Bowie is perceived by people and the way that he perceives himself as being perceived. Because, you know, he's singing, "Don't you know we're back on trial again today?" I think he might be, I think that might be
a sort of
critical reception or the, you know, the, and then the sort of mantra going out at the end is, it doesn't matter who you really are, doesn't matter what you, I think it's,
I found it intriguing. That's why I brought it up with you, because there was something about that song which sort of, it kind of sagged in the middle, but there was something very touching about it, and something quite intimate about it.
Yes,
you know,
the backing vocalists on it include his
The Coquettes.
There's all sorts of people, friends of his from Montreux and things. Yeah. But yes, among you, if you look through the credits on the album, you'll see that the backing vocalists on Zeros include Coco and Joe, and I think we know who both of those people are. So I think that's rather lovely as well. I don't know. I find it an extraordinarily moving song, really.
Yeah.
I'm not talking you into this, have I?
My hesitance comes from, again, the production.
Yeah.
Comes from, to me, the rather sort of clunky structure of the song, and then the sitar really bothered me. This, again, it to me, it didn't sound like what I think of with David Bowie. Yes. It sounded weak.
It's a very pastiche one, isn't it?
Very pastiche.
You know, the chords and the general soundscape of this guitar and everything. I mean, he's doing his thing of pinching little bits from here and there. There's a sense of 8 days a week.
It's a bit self-conscious almost.
And,
yeah.
I mean, it is a little bit self. It is. I think. Traffic's Paper Sun. And of course, there's a line about Little Red Corvette, which, you know, Prince was at his height then, wasn't he? Prince was doing, you know, Sign of the Times had not long come out at around about this time. Yes, he sings Me, My Little Red Corvette Has Driven By. He's having fun with us, I think.
Quickly, what was his take on Prince?
I think that Prince, certainly in terms of, especially as a live act, I don't think musically they had an awful lot in common. Although, actually, if you listen to something like Kiss, I suppose that intensely stripped down funky sound has got something to do with maybe fame and, you know, old Bowie stuff.
But
like
it's approach.
But I think it's the approach, and I think it's, you're right. And as a live act, obviously, Prince did sort of take on the mantle of what Bowie had been doing at the Ziggy time, didn't he? You know, he was, in terms of this sort of very exhibitionist, theatrical, showmanship. Bowie was still obviously on Glass Spider being exhibitionist. It's very interesting, isn't it? I don't see an obvious, you know, a sort of meaningful, weighty connection between Bowie and Prince. But in terms of them being, you know, fantastic performers, I think Bowie at the time, I think someone asked him at the time of Never Let Me Down, because of that reference in Zeros, they said, you know, is Prince the new Bowie, you know? And I think he did say something about, well, yeah, I guess in a way he's kind of the 80s version of what I was doing then, but I don't think he was passing the mantle.
No, but I mean, I certainly think Prince really had the same sort of impact, the same kind of outsider stroke mainstream impact that Bowie did in the 70s.
Yes.
Rather like Bowie as well. I mean, you can certainly see parallels. Yeah. And I think, again, going back to this album here, it's a very scattershot album. There's not the cohesion of a Low or a Ziggy or a Young.
I think
American.
Also, like a lot of albums of the early CD age, it's just actually a bit too long. You know, it could have lost a couple of tracks off the second side. And
hey, you've got to fill up that CD.
Yeah, well, exactly. That was the feeling in those days, wasn't it? Oh, we've got 18 minutes, whatever it is, fill it up. There is a couple of, I feel this especially about the second half of it. There's a couple of tracks there that probably, you know, could do without. Bowie himself, of course, obviously thought so, because in post 87 reissues of the album, one of the songs disappeared. The song called Too Dizzy was taken off it. Which is interesting. That's the only time he ever did that, you know, sort of deleted one
it's
of his own
so
songs.
So bad, it's
album.
Not even coming out.
And who knows why he did that, but, you know, it's very interesting. And it's interesting also, if you go back to Prince for a moment, I think a big difference between them at this point was that Prince had exactly what Bowie had, in the early to mid 70s in terms of, Prince made it seem effortlessly cool. Yeah. And he was effortlessly cool. Bowie by this stage was perhaps trying a little bit harder.
Exactly.
And, you know, you can look at the song Sign of the Times by Prince, in which it's an incredibly cool song and he references the space shuttle blowing up and AIDS and this and that and drugs and something. On Never Let Me Down, Bowie has a go at, you know, Chernobyl and things like that, and it doesn't sound anywhere near as cool as Sign of the Times.
I was going to mention this to you.
It's okay, but it feels more forced.
I was going to mention this to you because this is the album where he seems far more polemic and far more concerned with, you know, sort of weighing in on social matters.
Yeah.
You know, homelessness, AIDS. Of course, Chernobyl was contemporaneous with the recording of the album.
Yeah.
And I remember talking to friends about this album. There is that sense of, like, you know, rich pop star living in Switzerland, talking about homeless people in New York or AIDS. You know, there's a slight.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I'm always slightly wary of. It's better to talk about it than not to talk about it, isn't it? I mean, yes, he was a rich pop star, but
you understand that the criticism people make was like, it's all right for him and his Swiss mansion, isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. No, of course, that's true. But you know, well, for example, when he made the video for Day In Day Out, the first single from Never Let Me Down, he went off and shot it with, you know, the actors in that were from a community project for homeless people, and, you know, it's easy to, I do get what you're saying, I totally get, but yeah, I just think, well, hey, it's better to talk about it than just sit at home being a rich millionaire and not talk about it.
But it's what you said earlier about the Live Aid generation, and I think that's definitely one of the pathways that leads down to this, where the social conscience is broken.
I mean,
ultimately, we end up in Another Day in Paradise by Phil Collins. But
that's right. And again, is it like I was saying earlier on that this is a stepping stone to the next album, which of course was the first Tin Machine album. Now on the first Tin Machine album, he's absolutely he's just abandoned any pretense of being, you know, of sort of imagery and ambiguity, and directly singing songs about crack addiction under or video nasties
crack city.
And you know, some of those songs have a power to them, but they feel even less like Bowie songs because they just they're a little bit hectoring.
Well, they're not Bowie songs; they're Tin Machine songs.
Right. Gotcha. Yeah.
Exactly. Well, we have Time Will Crawl, which I think we mentioned earlier as is definitely one of the less awful songs here. Well, I mean, it's okay. It's not a bad song. I remember seeing this when I was very young on Top of the Pops, and I believe on one of those compilation clip programs where they shot a video for it, but then it actually went down.
That's right. They shot a studio performance of it. When the Glass Spider tour hit the UK, Bowie went in and pre-recorded a Top of the Pops appearance. But at that point, Top of the Pops adhered to a very strict policy of if the song was going down the charts, they wouldn't have it on. And by the time they, you know, when it was due to be shown, Time Will Crawl was already dropping out the charts. So yeah, they never showed it. Yeah.
That's a shame because that was a very fetching red boiler suit he was wearing in that video.
He's not wearing the red boiler suit in that one.
He's wearing this newsprint jacket.
That's right, this extraordinary PVC jacket with newspapers inside.
I get my red boiler suits and newsprint jackets all mixed up. But I mean, that's, you know, when we malign this album, as I was saying, I do. I mean, you know, Day In, Day Out is really not bad. Time Will Crawl's not bad. Like we've been discussing, I think the title track is It's Growing On Me, as we've been talking about it. Good. Zeros, I'm going to go back and revisit, I think. I'll give it another go. I mean, like I said, I just have to get through my sort of self-imposed cringe factor. But when I do that, I must say, I think you mentioned this earlier, but Shining Star really just... You know,
that one does
treacly.
Yeah, you know, that's one of the ones on the second side that I personally would have maybe just left off personally. Yeah. So there we are. I'm not going to defend all of it.
And this morning I listened again to New York's Another 87 and Cry, and I was just sort of catching off the minutes so I could sort this out. It's not a terrible album. It's not by far the worst album he's done. It's not the worst album of 1987. It's not the worst album of Bowie's canon. It's not a great one, but. Yeah, I'm kind of glad it's there.
Yeah, me too. And I think there's a lot of interest. I think it repays. It's a more rewarding album to spend some time with than I would say than Let's Dance or Tin Machine. I think, you know, controversial. Hey, we haven't even talked about Glass Spider yet. Shall I try and talk you into that one?
Song? Okay. I mean, I was kind of taking advantage of like the general air of bonhomie and goodwill. But I mean, if you want to talk about Glass Spider, let's talk about Glass Spider. Okay, bring it on.
This is where it's going to get really hard for you and for everyone, because I'm not going to be apologetic about this. I really, really, really like this song.
You really like this song?
I genuinely think it is a great song.
Okay.
Everything we've said before about iffy production still applies, but you know what I said before about imagine it produced brilliantly.
Yeah.
I think it's an extraordinary song. Now it opens with some narration about mystical spiders in the Far East.
There's a spider who lives in Zhuangdong province.
Yeah,
Their family.
Right. And of course it was written clearly with a view to being the opening number of the show, which it was. You know, he descended out of the belly of this giant spider sitting on a chair that was winched down, and he was singing the vocals into a telephone. And it was crazy. And it was, a little bit Spinal Tap. But then
you are blushing slightly, right?
I am blushing. But I think, I love the ambition, and this is one of the things I've always loved about Bowie, is that he was never afraid to step off the brink of potential ridicule. And on this occasion, boy, did he get ridiculed, you know. But I think that, I actually quite like the opening narration bit, but when the song really kicks in, you know, after the narration and we get into the riff and the guitars and everything, and I think it's terrific. I think it's got I think the chord sequence is wonderful. I think it's a very catchy song. Above all, I love the lyrics. It's okay. It's about a glass spider, but like all of David Bowie's songs, well, okay, not all, because we've just said this about Tin Machine, but like an awful lot of David Bowie songs, it's not actually about a glass spider, is it? It's a metaphor. This is a song, and I can say this reasonably confidently because Bowie said so himself. This is a song that's actually about that moment in our lives that we all come to when we realize that our parents aren't going to be there for us the whole time and that we're going to have to cope on our own. And that's what this sort of repeated chorus of Mummy Come Back as the water's all gone is about. And there are lines in there. I mean, put your preconceptions on the shelf and go back and listen to Glass Spider. At one point he sings, "If your mother don't love you, the riverbed might." I mean, what is that? That's like something from Philip Larkin. I think it is
incredibly dark.
Extraordinary. It is very dark. And you've got to get past the 80s production and the the real axe solo from Frampton.
I know, the intro, the production, the axe solo, but yet, as you say, the lyrical content and this Bowie mother thing. I mean, the spider has a mother significance in contemporary art and modern art and historical tradition. Bowie talking about his mother has happened before.
Yes.
I mean, you can't say he's literally talking about Peggy Jones.
No, of course. Because he never did anything as literal as that.
Yeah.
But I find, maybe I'm bonkers, but, you know, when he says the baby spiders would get scared and search frantically for their mother, but the glass spider had long gone, knowing that they'd survive on their own. I'm cracking up a little bit even saying it. I find that really chilling and moving and strange. And you know, how wonderful that something is out there as that he found room for it in a pretty straight ahead rock album, you know, and that's the essence of Bowie to me. So I really, really love this song. I'm not blind to the ridiculousness of it, but I love that. And I find it moving. So yeah, everybody listen to Glass Spider again. It's a brilliant song. If only he'd re-recorded it and done the music a bit better.
Well, I think that's a perfect place to leave this. I mean, you've certainly convinced me that it's definitely well worth another listen. And explore the album, go beneath the production, ignore the moments of sheer theatrical silliness. And I think, as Nick's saying, and I'm certainly agreeing now, there's a lot to love here. So maligned, ridiculed, silly cover.
I ain't going to defend that.
And in fact, Bowie's, the covers, you know, there have been some weird ones, but not good ones. But I think ultimately this is an album that does at least repay a couple of serious listens.
I really think so. Yeah.
So, Nick, thank you so much for this masterful argument. The My case pleasure. For Never Let Me Down.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you.
My pleasure.
When the fire broke out on the Rio Grande, put my foot to the board and she ate up the sand. With a horse of the south track chilling behind, a fire that aims to please. When the fires broke out on the Rio Grande, left nothing standing but the smell of the land. And the hot cats that burnt through the skin of your hand, left nothing at all but the sound of a rock and roll band.
And that was Bowie's Bruce Springsteen to the sound of Absolute Beginners. And a huge thanks to engineer Mark Saunders for giving us permission to use those clips. Very, very kind of him. And we will be hearing more from Mark in a future episode. So that's something to look forward to. So again, thanks to my guest Nicholas Pegg for a fantastic conversation. And thanks to you for listening. And do like, subscribe, review, rate, whatever you can do, which would be much, much appreciated by all of us here. And, well, I say all of us, it's me and my dog here, basically. And do keep tuned, because if you are still listening, that means there's a good chance you might come back next week when we have another repeat guest returning. Who could it be? To talk about another favourite Bowie album. So till then, all the best and do take care. Bye.